You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Koutou katoa ko Caden Tokawingawa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. My name is Caden and I'm your host for today. I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Panuja. E whai ake nei coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to MP Shannon Halbert about Labour's portfolio reshuffle ahead of the election, Phase 2 of the Royal Commission inquiry into COVID-19, and the results of the Select Committee inquiry into social media harm and young people. And for International Desk this week, I spoke to Deakin University Research Fellow Dr. Ali Mamouri about rising Islamophobia in Australian politics. For City Counselling this week, News Director Castor spoke to Councillor Shane Henderson about March Madness and changes to PC 120. Pranuja, what have you got for us today?
Today I spoke with Dr. Kelly Garten from the University of Auckland on her recent article comparing New Zealand's healthy school lunches program to Brazil's. We discussed the budget cuts to New Zealand's lunch program and what we could learn from Brazil's long-running national free school meal campaign.
He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so please get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wae mai rane. Give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Ka awa e wariwari e hiana koutou, te whakarongo ki e ne kōrero anō, e pakeheri rokiroki mārunga i te pai, tuhutuku o Erirangi Poho, mi haere ki 95BFM, erakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts on Lima Toru Iwa Lima 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309-3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
Labour has reshuffled its portfolios ahead of the election later this year. Notable changes include Willow Jean Prime losing the education portfolio for social development and Willie Jackson taking on Māori Crowd Relations. Vinushi Walters has also moved up significantly in Labour Party rankings, taking over Foreign Affairs. The Royal Commission inquiry into COVID-19 has released its final report for Phase 2 of the inquiry. The second phase was focused on whether the government took a balanced approach in their COVID response and found it largely did, with some caveats, including that the public was not brought on board enough. And the Education and Workforce Committee has released its final report on online harm and young people. The report included a range of recommendations, including establishing an independent national regulator for online safety and age restrictions for social media platforms. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to MP and member of the Education and Workforce Committee, Shannon Halbert, about all of these topics. I started by asking what motivated Labour's recent portfolio reshuffle.
Well, we had two good friends of mine from our Māori caucus, Penny Hinare and Adrian Rudafe, finished their time in Parliament, and so their portfolios needed to be reallocated. But given it's election year, I think it's important, like every year, to reset, refresh, and I think that's good for caucus.
Why does Willow Jean Prime no longer hold the education portfolio?
Willow Jean Prime has picked up the very large social development portfolio. She has the portfolio for children at the moment, and so that's great alignment with the work that social development does. And, of course, employment goes with that too. I like employment being aligned there because it's sort of the solution to the social development portfolio. And so I think it's great for Willow and I'm really happy for her.
You've picked up the Whānau Order portfolio. Can you explain what this means?
Yeah, I'm really honoured to pick up Whānau Ora. It has a wonderful legacy from Kahurangi Dame Tariana Tūria. Pēnei Henare held that portfolio as a minister, and of course Adrian Rudafe in opposition. Whānau Ora is a unique approach to make sure that the whole whānau is taken care of from a health and social service perspective. It means that we're looking at responses to not just the individual, but the people within the household and making sure that they're all looked after. So I'm really proud to pick up that portfolio. It's a Māori portfolio as well, and I think I'm able to bring a unique voice in Tāmaki Makaurau Auckland to that portfolio and across the country.
And you've also held on to your tertiary education portfolio. What are your priorities for this election year?
I'm very clear in the tertiary education portfolio that funding is a significant challenge, that the sector has been underfunded for a very long time, and that's a complex issue that I'm going to have to take forward both in opposition and should we go into government. We know that students are doing it tough with the cost of living. They've been really clear with me over the orientation periods at universities. Things are getting more expensive for them, both to live but also to study with the government's increase in student fees. So I've got a lot of work to do to make sure that we're able to make things easier, both for universities and students, both in the short term, but actually start to plan for fiscal responsibility in the long term for a sector that's done it tough.
And I want to turn now to ask about phase two of the COVID inquiry. What is your response to the final report?
My view is that it's quite a balanced response. It outlines the successes that I think most New Zealanders recognise, that we wanted a strong health response that prevented people from getting COVID. It also meant that we had the lowest unemployment rate at that particular time. But we know that times were tough throughout that period, that decisions had to be made, and there's consequences for those. And, you know, there's no surprises in some of the findings that there were difficulties throughout that period.
What do you think are the key lessons to take from the report?
The one that stands out for me, obviously, is the Auckland lockdowns. Every Aucklander felt disadvantaged by being locked down for a longer period than other New Zealanders. I still agree that it was the right decision, but what the report says is that 6 days, that the lockdown lasted 6 days longer than it probably needed to. So, you know, that's something we'll reflect on. Most importantly for me is that we prepare for such situations that could come to us in future. We've got to be more responsive. We can't just go back to that there wasn't a playbook for this. There is now a playbook, and we've got to make sure that we're planning for the future.
New Zealand First has called for an inquiry into vaccine harm specifically. Is this something you'd support?
No. How many reviews do we need? How many inquiries do we need? New Zealanders recognise that was a very difficult time. We stand up internationally as one of the best responses in the world. Our economy came through that. It was difficult, and difficult decisions had to be made, but we're all the better for it as a result. So I think that the time spent now is better spent on things like the cost of living, things like making sure that we address our homelessness problems in this country and the supply of housing and the affordability of it, and of course access to quality healthcare that everyone can afford.
And I want to turn to ask now, what are your thoughts on the results of the Select Committee inquiry into online safety, particularly for young people?
That's a very good report in my view. We spent a number of weeks in the Education and Workforce Select Committee working through this, debating some of the issues. And between Labor and National, I think it's one of the pieces of work that will stand out in this parliamentary term, where we have been able to work together for an issue that we're all concerned about and put some really good recommendations up to the Minister.
How many of these recommendations will Labor take on board?
Well, some of them would take longer than others. The part that's important to me is that, of course, we've got to keep young people safe online. Under Labor, of course, we started this work in the Relationship and Sexuality Guidelines piece in schools. That was removed under this government. So there's part of starting again, I guess, that we have to work through and which whereabouts we start. There was an agreement around the table in full. The ACT Party and the Green Party had concerns about the report. They wanted it to go further in different ways. But I think that we've landed on a really balanced way forward, and we're really clear on the things that need to be done in order to prevent harm to young people online.
I want to ask about that point about the ACT Party disagreeing with the report. They say the results of the inquiry were predetermined. Why do you disagree with that?
Well, I just can't see throughout the weeks we were working together how it was predetermined. It was a long period of time that we worked on this particular inquiry. We heard from a number of public submitters at a community level, at a parent level. So I can't point to a place where suddenly in the background National and Labor did a secret deal and predetermined the outcome. That's just not true.
That was Labor MP Shannon Halbert on Labor's portfolio reshuffle ahead of the election, Phase 2 of the Royal Commission inquiry into COVID-19 and the results of the Select Committee inquiry into social media harm and young people.
That was our weekly chat with Labor MP Shannon Halbert.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
These past 2 weeks have seen traffic in the city peaking, with the start of March Madness heralded in by students returning to university and people returning to work. While Auckland Council is working to bolster public transport services, some parts of the city still run into major congestion issues. The past week has also seen discussions around Planning Change 120, more commonly referred to as PC 120, while the plan initially proposed a housing cap of 2 million for Auckland, the government has pushed for it to be reduced to 1.6 million. The council has responded with a set of compensatory changes and would focus on reducing sprawl and boosting CBD intensification. Auckland Mayor Wayne Brown spoke particularly strongly on the changes, indicating that if the government did not accept the change, they would stick to the original 2 million target. For City Counselling this week, News Director Kester spoke to Councillor Shane Henderson about each of these issues, beginning with March Madness.
I wanted to start off with March Madness. Well, everyone in the city who's been on the roads recently will have seen the traffic. How well is Auckland handling things at the moment?
Oh, it's pretty tough every year. So uni gets back and everybody gets back in March, and so you get this big spike of activity in terms of traffic and also public transport patronage and all the rest of it. AT have been sort of preparing for this as they do every year. And so, you know, that it's always going to be a bit hard this time of year, but I think we're coping reasonably well. Of course, I'd love to hear people's feedback, so feel free to get in touch if you're having some difficulties with your commute. And, yeah, we can have a look at what's going on there.
And what kind of changes or upgrades are we making to alleviate the impact of this every year?
Yeah, well, AT look at things like frequency of buses and these kind of things all the time. And also part of that is promoting that you do have transport alternatives, so you don't necessarily need to drive in. If you don't have to, you can try out things like the bus or the train. It's a pretty good excuse this time of year to see how it works, yeah.
Despite some of these upgrades, you know, we've got a lot of our busways and train connections which are alleviating some of the pressure because they can evade the main roads. But when it comes to taking buses on our main roads, you can still get stuck in traffic. And I know for a lot of university students, there's that bottleneck where the 70 often gets stuck around Grafton campus. Is the council looking into making changes here and improving some of these bottleneck situations?
Yeah, really frustrating thing. I have one on my commute on the 13 and Tiernsee Road as well. Yeah, council are always looking at kind of arterials and whether we could be looking at changing lanes to sort of more suit the environment. And we've seen some arterials over the past few years looking at T2, T3 and bus lanes. And that sort of work that's been sort of rolling out as the demand is there. So that's a good tip on that Grafton route there. I'll have a little bit of a look at that when I get off the phone.
All right. And moving on to PC 120, we've seen some changes being proposed by the government and being looked at by council. What does the change mean for Auckland?
Yeah. So initially the PC 120 target capacity was 2 million. So that's not 2 million extra houses tomorrow. That is the enabled capacity in the city where you could, if you could make the finances stack up, build, right? If that makes sense. Government recently backed down to a $1.6 million figure. They claimed that it was a result of feedback, which was a bit curious for me because we haven't seen any feedback. It hasn't come through and been analysed yet. But nevertheless, the sort of back down means there will be slightly less intensification enabled than the city was planning. Our council meeting, pretty torturous the other day, but we got there in the end. Said, look, if you're looking to downzone things from 2 million to 1.6, then start with the areas that are way outside of the city centre, so more than 10 kilometres. And those are places like Howick, those are places like Massey and Te Aroha as well. Those are the places where we should be if we can, making things a bit more appropriate, because in the central city there is access to public transport, there's better water infrastructure and all the rest of it. I could go on and on and on. But that's kind of where we're at the moment. So we passed that through. So we'll sort of see how that process goes in the next sort of few weeks and few months. Could be a bit of an interesting one.
And a lot of the discussions around this have talked about minimising sprawl. Auckland's got a reputation for, you know, expanding outwards. Why is council looking at minimising sprawl? What kind of problems does it pose?
Oh, yeah, the problems with sprawl are extensive. So, partially it's expensive to service, so you've got to get new pipes out to these developments that are miles away. You have to look at bus routes and libraries, community centres, all these kind of this infrastructure that's both sort of hard and soft infrastructure. You have to fund that, and so the city pays huge for these for sprawl. It also creates worse outcomes in terms of the environment, and you're looking at things like southern Auckland, where elite soils are kind of the lifeblood of our economy, both as a city and as a country. I would argue you should not be paving over that and putting housing on it. You should be using it for your economic development. You're creating transport climate emissions with asking people to commute further away from their work. There are health impacts, there are social impacts, impacts on parenting and family life, you name it. I think that sprawl is a really difficult thing for the city, and we should be trying to focus on a compact city approach as much as we can.
And on that compact city approach, the mayor was talking about intensification in some central city suburbs, places like Parnell, Mount Eden, Epsom and Ponsonby. We've seen concerns about intensification affecting some of the heritage parts of those suburbs and the character. How is council balancing those concerns, the need for more houses close to the city centre, with also the concerns of people living in those neighbourhoods already?
Yeah, well, I can tell you how council's doing it. I mean, this was one of the big blow-ups that we had at the committee, probably the major blow-up the other day. The central suburbs have huge amounts of special character protection. So what that means is it's important to have a distinction there between special character and heritage, right? So heritage is legally required to be protected. It is provably historic, and it goes through a process to do that. Special character, however, is something that is more subjective. It looks old, frankly. And that can be entire neighbourhoods. I mean, there are some parts of the city which have over 90% special character protection. We can argue whether that's justified or not. I certainly have personal views about that. But what council is doing about it is they are still protecting large swathes of special character that was protected under the unitary plan that has minimised, though, through this process. I think that's a good thing. There'll be plenty of colleagues on the council that don't think that, and that's fine. That's their democratic right too. That's kind of what council is doing about it. There are concerns in the neighbourhood, but at the same time, we need to balance this against the needs of a modern world city that's growing.
And on the modern city, the mayor also made some of his personal views clear. He talked about Auckland currently being something akin to the world's largest suburb. Could you go into that a little bit, what it looks like sort of building a city for the future and how Auckland compares to some of our international counterparts?
I really like that line. It's a bit sad though, isn't it? So, there are plenty of us out there that want Auckland to become the city that it can be, that can be inspiring for people and can attract talent and not have them leave it for greener pastures and for cheaper house prices. And part of that, to me, is allowing housing to be built that gives people choices in their housing, close to work, close to study, close to public transport. And often those are places in the central city. These are suburban areas of the city that maybe need to be a little bit higher. And that's part of any world city. If you go to any place in the world that has equivalent population or more, then they are growing up around their city centre where the jobs are and where the study is. This is something that I've been advocating for a long time.
That was Auckland Councillor Shane Henderson speaking to News Director Kester about March Madness and changes to PC 120.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
That's probably slightly off topic. What was the question again?
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat. Text in your thoughts 5395.
Iconic songwriter Lloyd Cole is hitting the stage in Auckland this Friday to entertain fans with a career-spanning solo performance. And if you're a B-card holder, you could have your hot little hands on some free tickets. Just keep your ears perked up during 95BFM Breakfast for your cue to win.
Are you ready to be heartbroken?
Lloyd Cole at the Hollywood Avondale this Friday. Get your tickets now at plusone.co.nz.
Garth, where's your hat? No hat, no play.
I don't have one, sir.
Then go on and pick a hat from Lost Property.
Oh, sir, those hats all have nits.
It's nits or melanoma, Garth.
It's a no hat, no play summer, so it's lucky 95BFM have you sorted with sweet merch for your noggins. Choose from four designs, two classic cap designs, one cord design, and a bucket hat. Pre-order yours now from twotonesmerch.co.nz.
All right, you four Muppets, listen up. I finally pinpointed 95BFM's weak spot, Friday night, 7 till 9 p.m. The staff have all gone to watch Rick Breeze play water polo, so that's when we're going to strike. Phil, you're cracking the safe. Renee, you're disabling the alarm. Pat Fife, you load this BFM CD library into this sack. And Professor, you're driving the getaway van. Kushti. Ha ha ha, they're never going to see this coming.
Gang of Four, every Friday night from 7 till 9 p.m. with a revolving cast of bona fide BFM legends, Renee, Pat, Phil and the Professor are putting the B into TBIF. Gang of Four, thanks to Verona, the heart of Karangahape Road.
West Coast, chopping.
Regan, wake up.
East Coast.
Honey, onshore. You're having those strange nightmares. Oh, no, no, it's not.
1 out of 10 on both.
Oh, God! Father Damien, it's happening again!
Looking for tubular swells? It's the 95BFM Surf Report. Is the West Coast gnarly? Is the East Coast bogus? Do people even still use these words? Find out every morning on Breakfast and every afternoon on Drive. The Totally Radical Surf Report, proudly brought to you by the dudes and dudettes at ProGear.
We're Māori! And we won't get justice till we've got a Māori flag.
Chile.
Represent the red, white and black from the abyss. Erupt like through a pet who cover the land like mist. Out of my tepoa, uri uri ki te awaramai. Hit the voice of Tipuna. Echo throughout the valley. I know what was signed, cause in 1840, attacking our peak spirituality. Self-autonomy fought for with the vengeance. Resurrect, organized to seek justice. So upliftment is assured. Takahia.
In the hearts.
America. Subjected to apartheid, segregated, separated from my culture, destroying from within. Deprived of heritage in the system, swearing allegiance to the Queen of Mother England. See no longer to the tongue of the charger here from the angle of Tonga Whenua. Engulfing craniums with this from the cerebellum.
Them belly full, but we
hungry for knowledge of self, restrict this emphasis and the upliftment of consciousness.
Won't go away.
Listen up tonight. No one can sign away our birthright.
National Desk are go.
In February, Australian politician Pauline Hanson made headlines for an interview with Sky News where she suggested there are no good Muslims. And an independent report from last year found anti-Muslim incidents in Australia had skyrocketed since the start of Israel's war on Gaza. This has been amplified by the charged political environment in the wake of the Bondi terrorist attack and the government's subsequent plan to combat anti-Semitism, which conflated anti-Semitism with criticism of the State of Israel. For International Desk, I spoke to research fellow at Deakin University, Dr. Ali Mamouri, about this rising Islamophobia in Australian politics and its consequences. I started by asking about Pauline Hanson and if he could explain who she is and her recent comment about no good Muslims.
Pauline Hanson is the head of the One Nation Party, which is one of the right parties in Australia. It has a minimum political influence, but in the larger context in Australia, especially her everyone's statement or action caused a lot of controversies and concern among Australian society. In particular, in the last few weeks, she said that there is no good Muslims, which was very controversial and insulting to about a million Muslim people in Australia and 2 billion Muslims in the world. It was so strange and surprising to hear such a thing, that among that large community, there is not any even one good person. It was absolutely a racist and a discriminative statement.
And I want to ask, can you speak to how this reflects wider trends of Islamophobia in Australia?
Absolutely. Pauline Hanson and One Nation have contributed significantly to normalizing Islamophobic rhetoric in public debate. A statement such claiming that there are no good Muslims effectively dehumanize an entire community, or nearly 1 million Australians and around 2 billion people globally, as I said. And this type of rhetoric undermines social cohesion because it places Muslims in a position where they constantly feel they must prove their loyalty humanity in order to be accepted as equal citizens, create the perception of Muslims as second-class citizens, and foster suspicion toward an entire community. At the same time, I strongly support maximum freedom of speech. In fact, for this reason, I have also criticized recent hate speech legislation in Australia. Liberal democracies should prioritize open debate rather than restricting speech through broad legal tools. But the point here is that what raised concern is that apparently there is a double standard in how speech is treated. For example, we have recently seen young protesters arrested in Australia just yesterday for political slogans related to Israel and Palestine. Where phrases like from a river to the sea or intifada sometimes interpreted it as anti-Semitic and criminalized. Yet a statement like portraying all Muslims negatively often received with less problem or with almost no consequences. This issue, therefore, is not simply the about the speech itself, is about the consistently, fairly dealing and treating with different communities.
The specific piece of legislation that you mentioned, the plan to combat anti-Semitism, could you speak to how this could impact responses to Islamophobia?
Of course. The entire legislation took the public attention to some kind of distraction. An issue happened in Australia. It was so horrific. It was very dangerous. It was so sad to see the terrorist attack here in Bondi Beach a few months ago. But the question is not about free speech or even hate speech. The cause of a problem was a few questions regarding the security organizations here in Australia. The question is that why the intelligence service was not able to track them before take such a terrorist horrible action? Why police was late like half an hour to come and address? Why they did not take proaction to provide protection to Jewish community? All these things should be addressed and should be improved. There is a significant and serious problem in how government is providing safety and security to all communities in Australia. This is the main issue. But it seems to me that government, instead of addressing the source of a problem, it went completely toward limiting freedom of speech, limiting social media activities, and going toward some kind of policing the public debate, which is so dangerous a trend for our future and for our liberal democracy.
Do you think any of this has been changed or altered in any way by the ongoing US-Israel war with Iran?
Of course, that's an extra a problem that is happening here in Australia. When we see that in such conflict, the Australian government does not stand with international law and just follow their partnership with the U.S. and give priority to that over any kind of legal institution globally. And it's a very dangerous trend, because if Australia does not stand with international law, this war, according to all experts, was a breach of international law, and Australia should not support it. When Australia supports such a violation of international law, it will put the country in at risk if another country wants to do the same with Australia? How could Australia rely on the international law? And second, will create a lot of polarization inside the society, showing that the government is not fair. The government is not based on institutional setting. It just take decision based on political partnership with foreigner partners. In addition to all of these, we have been witnessing a lot of public protests here in Australia after the events in Iran. Some of them with very strong Islamophobic rhetoric and slogan, something like all clerics should be buried. And with no any consequences, with no any arrangement to limit that or to stop that or at least to discuss that. So it seems in general that there is a context politically and socially that put Muslim communities behind the accusation bar. It seems that they need to constantly just clarify their position and just to make sure we are not supporting any terrorism or any authoritarian regime, which we are not. But it doesn't seem acceptable that they should come every single time and just clarify their position.
This discussion has been focused on what is happening in Australia, but are we seeing any similarities or even parallels in other places?
Of course, it's a part of the global context. A global context that wants to portray Muslims as backward people, nations, as people with all just authoritarian regime, dismissing their variety, dismissing the large societies and countries from Southern Asia to Northern Africa. We have different kind of governance system like any other religious groups. It's not acceptable to say, for example, in Rwanda we had 90% Christians, but the genocide that happened in Rwanda has nothing to do with the Christianity. Same thing if there is a terrorist attack somewhere among 2 billion Muslims. A few people does something or do something that does not give us any kind of legitimate reason to accuse the entire society. But it seems that there is a public, general, global propaganda run by some political motivations, which is clear in the current global context, to portray them as demon, as non-human, as second human, as backward, as people that causing a problem, ruining the global order, dismissing any other factor among this large community and also among other communities that they are contributing in the same way or sometimes worse.
That was Deakin University Research Fellow Dr. Ali Mamouri on rising Islamophobia in Australian politics.
International Desk on 95BFM.
I'm not sure of our position on that particular bill, so I can't comment on that right now.
It's a kind of bird. This is the bird they're endorsing for Bird of the Year.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat. Text in your thoughts, 5395.
Well, if you want to save money and health, it's very simple, you know. It's like shoot all the patients and shut all the hospitals.
The Wire.
Last year, the government announced significant budget cuts to the school lunch program, formerly known as Ka Ora Ka Ako, reducing the funding available per meal and reshaping how the program is delivered in schools. Now, the school lunch program covers only a quarter of schools, based on the equity index, reaching about 240,000 students. So more than half of children experiencing food insecurity do not attend schools receiving this program. New research by Dr. Kelly Garten, a research fellow in the School of Population Health at the University of Auckland and a spokesperson for Health Coalition Aotearoa, compares New Zealand's program with Brazil's national school meal system, which has been running for over 70 years and is considered a global gold standard. I spoke with Dr. Garten about what New Zealand could learn from Brazil's approach to school meals and what a stronger program here might look like. So, child food insecurity is currently at an all-time high in Aotearoa. How is this impacting our tamariki?
Well, I mean, kids at school who are hungry can't learn properly. It's also a matter of child rights. You know, every child in New Zealand should be able to, you know, be happy and healthy and well-fed. And we're a country that produces enough food to feed, you know, way more than our population. And so it's a bit ridiculous that we have so many hungry kids.
Last year, the government made budget cuts to the New Zealand Healthy School Lunches Program, formerly Ka Ora Ka Ako. How is this affecting students in schools today?
Yeah, well, the existing program that we had was a really high-functioning program. Kids were, you know, feeling more full after lunch. They had, you know, better focus. Teachers were noticing better behavior. And this also had an impact on things like learning outcomes and also attendance rates for the kids who were most at risk of missing school. With the cuts to the program, basically the budget was cut by more than half, and it made it really difficult for the remaining suppliers to deliver on quality and safety. And we saw a lot of issues with the food that was delivered to the high schools under the new model in the last year. So I think this has created more waste. There are more uneaten lunches. And I think it's created a lot of distrust and in the program. And at the end of the day, it's our kids who are suffering out of this. They've taken what was a really high-functioning program that had impacts on local economies because local jobs were being created. It had health impacts in the long term. It had some great educational impacts. And it had some good environmental impacts as well. And we reduced this to, you know, how could we do the bare minimum and cut this as a cost, instead of looking at this program as an investment in our tamariki, an investment in our future as a country.
Now, in your recent article about national school meal programs, you describe the Brazilian national program as a global gold standard. What makes Brazil's system work so well?
Yeah, well, it's been running for about 70 years now. And over that time, they've obviously learned some important lessons about delivering food to, I think, 40 million kids is what the program delivers to now. Over time, they have gone from a more centralized program that mainly relied on like shelf-stable processed foods to having a model where they procure food from local family farms. So they're able to get like more fruits and vegetables, more healthy, nutritious, minimally processed food into the meals. That also creates, you know, more local jobs, more local employment. They also have really strong limits on how much of the food being served is ultra-processed. So the kids are getting really healthy, nutritious meals, but they serve it to all kids in all public schools across the country. So it's not seen as an equity program. It's not a handout. It's actually just a fundamental right of the children going to school to have a healthy, nutritious lunch provided to them for free.
In your article, you mentioned that school meals can improve not just nutrition for the kids, but also education outcomes and even local economies. Could you talk a little bit about those wider benefits?
Yeah, so in the original Kaoraka Ako, schools had the opportunity to work with local suppliers of their choice and work with that supplier on developing menus that would, you know, work with their student population, be appealing and nutritious, adhere to the nutrition standards. And then there is a feedback system where they could look at continuous quality improvement and control. Now, that system had created about 2,455 jobs, according to Ministry of Education data in 2022. A lot of those jobs were for family members and other people in the community who might otherwise be marginally employed or underemployed. So it did have a really important economic impact. When the new model came about in 2025 and the cost or the price per meal was drastically reduced, it left only a small handful of large suppliers that could commit to a contract. But at the end of the day, those major suppliers still weren't able to deliver on quality and safety, and so they've had to go back to the drawing board. And I think we really need to come back to this local provision model that gives schools the choice of suppliers they want to work with, that allows for this local employment as well, and also just local ownership and engagement in the program.
Can you touch on how the mindset between Brazil and New Zealand shapes the way that their program is designed?
Yeah, in Brazil, there is a constitutional right to food, and children are expected to go to school every day, and so they're fed at school every day. So it's not a matter, it's not seen as an equity program. It's not seen as social assistance or a handout. It's actually just seen as something we do as a society is, you know, we have education for our children and we feed them at school. So it's a mindset shift that, you know, part of education and investing in their future as a country is to feed kids healthy food at school. And part of that gets integrated into the curriculum as well, where they start learning about how to eat well. They sit together, they learn about manners, they learn, you know, about the social cohesion benefits of sitting and sharing a meal together. Kids also tend to try more things if everybody sits and has the same thing. There's sort of a peer support mechanism there. In New Zealand, what we've seen since the coalition government took over the program is that the school lunch program is a cost they'd like to cut. They want to strip it down to the bare minimum rather than looking at this as a matter of child rights and rather than looking at this as an investment.
And what are some key lessons New Zealand could learn from Brazil in supporting our tamariki?
I think the number one thing is that we need legislation to make a school lunch program, a healthy school lunch program, permanent. This back and forth and, you know, debate over whether it will be in the budget every year or 2 years is causing a lot of uncertainty. No one's able to properly invest in the infrastructure, the structures needed to keep the program going and running efficiently. We need to have a guaranteed program running in perpetuity. And that's what's happened in Brazil. There's legislation that guarantees a minimum budget for their school lunch program to keep running every year. We also need to see our program appropriately funded. So the budget cuts in 2025 were way too large. So we would like to see the program appropriately funded. And what principals tell us is that schools need about $6 per meal per child a day, rather than the $3 and something they're getting right now. So it needs to be appropriately funded, permanent, and we also would actually like to see it scaled up to be reaching more kids.
That was Dr. Kelly Garten on New Zealand's Healthy School Lunch Program.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nē te mihi kia koutou katoa, I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rā Pārē Thursday. Nē rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana, thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, Labour's Shannon Halbert, Auckland Council Shane Henderson, Deakin University's Ali Mamouri, and University of Auckland's Kelly Garten. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Sophia. We'll be right back.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.